Jason, okay, kind of learning about the starting of the country that ran first the month and you're talking about around the 4th of July, but in with the Jason Norman and the Declaration of Independence. Well, after the Declaration of Independence was signed by the signers there, and it began to be publicly read on July 18th, 1776, in Boston, Massachusetts, the New England Chronicle newspaper had a story that said from the balcony of the old State House in Boston, Massachusetts, at 1 p.m. before a cheering crowd, that Colonel Thomas Craft publicly read the Declaration of Independence for the first time in that city. A couple of weeks after this, somebody pretty much used the Declaration in time, but it was actually read out loud. Just all of this town, up throughout the next several weeks, it was then read in different towns. But if you pick up another publication on that same day, the newspaper, the Continental Journal, it would tell you story about the same event taking place in the same state, the same place, the old State House in Boston at the same time, 1 p.m., same cheering crowd. But rather than being read by Colonel Thomas Craft, the Continental Journal said that it was Sheriff William Greenlee who publicly read the Declaration of Independence for the first time that day. So what does that mean? Were they confused? Is the story wrong? What happened? And what do we take from it? Well, they couldn't get that story right, so maybe there wasn't any Declaration of Independence at all. Maybe it was not read anywhere. Well, that's kind of like when people begin to look at biblical scriptures and other because you said that parallel. Can't be right. It's contradictory. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't. That's the view often taken in regarding the Bible. When minor differences in text come up, a lot of times people throw out the baby with bathwater. And then we see here we have two newspaper accounts telling us very similar things, but we have something a little different, something we don't understand. Well, how do we fix that? How do we find out the truth? Well, I think if I saw a lie that was there in July 18, 1776, we can't ask them. So we start sort of piecing together what happened. Today we want to look at the Gospels. I mean, you can really apply most of this to the entire Bible. But we're going to focus on the Bible to keep it within our time limit for the day, that is, and the points that we can bring up. And we had two accounts of the reading of the Declaration of Independence. We talked about the Gospel of Jesus Christ's life. We have four. They have four accounts. But they're different. They have differences, don't they? They're distinct from one another. So what do we take from that? Well, one witness is usually just not enough. So even though two people can be telling the exact same story, sometimes they can tell it to us in different words. They might include some of the same items, but maybe not the same detail of the item. If we begin to make careful inquiries, then we can begin to sort of piece together maybe what was the whole story? Why are there maybe minor differences in the details sometimes? You know, the police run into that if they somebody witnesses a crime. They say that eyewitness testimony is actually the least reliable source of information. You think, well, you saw it, and you don't know what you saw. we've all throughout our life, you see things and you saw them, and sometimes it doesn't really occur to me. Many years ago, I'm driving down Brighton Avenue in Pensacola, Florida. I was working down there. We lived down there at that time. Driving down Brighton. It was a help spot I saw a little bit earlier, but when I got to this, come around this corner, and there was a camel truck, for delivery type camel truck, and he was going that way across a parking lot that was off. He wasn't anywhere really close to me. He saw it to the right, going diagonally to the parking lot, and that in itself didn't cause my mind to think something, was amiss necessarily, until I saw him run over a retaining wall with the truck into another parking lot that was a little bit lower. And so then I began to pay attention. Just kind of through that retaining wall. And then he's going. He hits a building. He actually runs through the corner of a building or a business that was there. It took to that point before my mind says, this is an accident. This is happening. This guy is something happened to this driver. I don't know what happened. I need to stick around to find out. I called, there was some help, called 911 to get some people there to see about it, to get the guy some help. But I didn't hang around to see why. Obviously, lost consciousness, I would be the only real answer to that. Could have been other answers. This brake went out or something, but he obviously wasn't in control of the vehicle. It was just your mind kind of like, was it, And your mind kind of goes back then and pieces things together over the, next day, week, year. Okay, well then, if I don't know earlier, he might run into me, but if he had to come across the road I was driving now, and things that occurred to you later on. But you don't always necessarily remember everything that was going on. But we have four gospels, so we have an opportunity to kind of piece together maybe what always happens. And we know that they are distinct from one another. Let's begin in Luke chapter 1. Luke was obviously someone who had some knowledge of the events of Christ's ministry and his crucifixion and death. As we start here in Luke chapter 1, verse 1, Luke writes, "Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, deliver them to us. Verse 3, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed." So Luke is obviously aware of other accounts of Christ's ministry. And he mentions it here that he knows that there's other things that he sets down to make an account of those things. And we kind of touch on it later, but Paul later on says that Luke was a beloved physician. Luke was, and he's obviously being more or less of his task by Mr. Theophilus here, who was some Greek magistrate, obviously, with the story this man had heard. The story, and then Luke had some connection with it. He sort of contracted him, probably asking to write him a story of that. And Luke, it seems Luke went back and sort of filled in some of the details that he didn't know. Some of the things that he probably wouldn't have been there for. He asked people that were there and got more of a whole story than that. So we know that there's differences in the gospel. Because of that. And that doesn't hurt the veracity of the gospel. It helps. It helps you to kind of know some more of the details, because some for different reasons cut things out. And others put those things in, and say, lose. Apparently, after some time, because they knew there were other accounts, lose. Actually trying to get more of a complete account of what's going on there. So the Gospels then can be verified. The Gospels are authentic. But they were also written by different people, different individuals, different at different times with different points of view. We knew that they were actually written by these individuals, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, who lived during this time. So the authorship necessarily of these books is not claiming specifically in the text. That actually kind of helps with the rest of it. They weren't promoting themselves. You know, Luke never comes out and says, hey, I'm Luke, I'm writing this down, you know. Never really mentions himself. John never says, I am Apostle John, I'm writing this stuff all down for you. But their names were on the original Bible that they wrote to people. Their names were then at the top of the scroll. And so they didn't have any kind of personal statement, you know, not about the author's statement in there or anything. They were accounts of you. If you go back to the earliest, like, you know, the actual original manuscript, or even around it, they just, you know, they were writing on them. The paper of the time, the paper or whatever, all that stuff, just the stuff eventually is kind of all the pieces. So none of those around, but if you go back to the earliest manuscript, then you see these documents still have those names attached to them. So they have that as far as that. Well, what about some of the books? We can start with Mark. Well, who's Mark? Who is Mark? It's not really, once again, it's not obvious from reading his gospel. You know, Mark's one of the shorter accounts. But it's described by the individual known as John Mark. That kind of helps with an otherwise name who's called Mark. So the first name is John. We had more than one John. The quick head is separated. So you do that too with Matthew. Matthew's sometimes called Levi. The names are sort of interchangeable a lot of times. That would be probably a good, you know, little study or, you know, maybe a sermon of the disciples were somewhere and where they came from, what their actual names, and what those names maybe had to do with their positions or whatever, where they were the family. But anyway, and looking over to Acts. Look at Acts, chapter 12. We're going to go to Mark. I know where Mark said who he was. Let's go to Acts. As we said, Acts chapter 12. Just to find out. And we start out with this whole account here of Herod that is persecuting the followers of Jesus Christ. And verse 3 says he killed James, and then verse 3 says, and the Jews, you know, the authorities, they liked that. That was good for them. You know, the people were calling them a problem. You know, another part said they turned the world upside down. So there's, yeah, go there. The Herodian was the second Herod. So yeah, do that for us. It really people. So he had, you know, Peter arrested. Peter, you know, probably not be killed, but didn't get out any other way, but then I knew. Freezing. And so they get out and go to a house here. Verse 12, it says, so when he had considered this, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark. And there were other people there gathered together. These people were all known to Peter, because they were pretty excited. We have a story of a lady goes to answer the door and she recognizes Peter. She leaves him outside. Ah, Peter! Leaping at the front door, you know, then laying in. So we have a connection between John Mark and Peter. And he's been visible at the time, so Peter had a connection. Peter would have known what he was writing about. we skip on down the end of that well. We have this individual again, sort of referred to the same in verse 25. It says that Barnabas and Saul, which were then Paul, Barnabas, and once again, the thing with the names, returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their ministry, and they also took with them John, whose surname was Mark. What does this tell us? Well, Mark had a connection more with the Gentiles. We do know that Matthew wrote more to the Jewish people. Matthew was a very dedicated, very religious person from the Galilee area. Talked about him with my mouth, Jesus' ministry. He went to this area, and these people were very religious. They were very serious about their religion. And that's where Matthew was too. Was very serious about his belief in the Messiah coming and that. But Matthew went to the point where he would use because of the connection with the belief of the time, he used the term kingdom of God. He was like heaven, kingdom of heaven. And so he was driving more to the Hebrew, more to the Israel, more to the Israelite time. Well, you see that Mark has a connection to the Gentiles. And we can see some aspects of that. We go to Mark chapter 7. Back in Mark chapter 7, the way Mark was treated, the information is, and he's writing it down. John Mark here is writing, now when they saw some of the disciples eat bread with defiled, that is, unmarked hands, they found salt. Well, if we go to Matthew 15, we read the same story. That's basically all Matthew says. What does Matthew talk? Matthew's talking to Israelites. They knew what the Pharisees did, why they did it, what they did. Mark takes the opportunity to go into a few more details about this. Verse 3 of Mark 7 says, for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way, holding to the tradition of the elders. Mark said, he would be talking to Pharisees and Jews and Platonism, but right now, they would have already known that. So he's talking more to the Gentile nation. Verse 4, it says, when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other things which they have received and hold, like the washing of cups, pitchers, copper vessels, and couches. So the Pharisees had a lot of religious ways that they washed, and it was very, very important to them. But Mark wouldn't have had to explain that to them. So why? You can tell Mark kind of writing more to the the Greek mind, the Gentile mind, people that weren't that familiar with the Jews. Mark does tend to do that in other places. He tailors his message for the Gentiles. He explains Jewish customs. Matthew doesn't. Matthew's pretty much talking to the Jewish people himself. You know, why would Matthew bother to explain these things? He was, talking to people who knew it. He was a Jew from Galilee. They were known to be very simple people, but extremely religious people. Speaking of Matthew, so Matthew speaking more to the Jews of the time of the gospel message, Matthew contains the most Old Testament prophecy quotes of any of the gospels. And actually,
31% of Matthew's entire gospel is quoted out of the Old Testament prophecy. That's what it fits. He was very righteous, very religious. He was from the nation of Galilee. He was a Jew from Galilee. And that's what Christ tells us that, doesn't it? Let us know what his message was about. He's been waiting for this fulfillment from Messiah for his entire life. And it's exciting to him. And he's meticulously pointing out to the Jews anywhere he can to emphasize how Jesus Christ fulfills these prophecies from the Old Testament. There are a few other things. Matthew chapter 17. There's some other things that were speaking to Matthew's personality, to his particular character, situation. Matthew 17, verse 24, says when they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" Well, Jesus didn't really believe that he was required to pay the temple tax, but he didn't want to, this was not something that he needed to make an issue out of. So he performed a miracle and pulled the coins out of the fish. So why was he included in Matthew? Matthew was a tax collector. It stood out in his memory that this idea of taxes and who was required to pay taxes and why they were required to pay taxes. Matthew seems to be the only one who remembers this story of Jesus paying his taxes to America. So it fits Matthew's history and his character. It's relevant to the background of Matthew. We mentioned Luke earlier. Luke wrote a very orderly account for the Greeks. He wrote it in the style of Greek history. And he kind of lets us know that he was writing the account. He was not really an eyewitness. He traveled with the apostle preaching the gospel. So he also writes the book of Acts. We had first go to Acts chapter 1, verify that. It starts the same way. Acts 1, verse 1 says, "The former account I made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began to do and to teach." But he's connected to the book of Acts. A lot of his gospel does come from eyewitness account, but it goes outside of that, getting more of the story from other individuals. Includes unique events that are outside of those items that of the other 12 disciples. And we know that Paul told us in Colossians 4 and verse 14, he was a doctor. That's the only reference we have in being called a physician. Paul didn't necessarily go out of his way to bring this out. He just put this point. That he was very orderly that way. He had the mind of a doctor, and he made a very orderly account. Being a doctor, in Luke chapter 22, Luke chapter 22, down verse 44, something that Luke points out that Russell and Don. This is right before Christ was to suffer, and he is in agony. Verse 44 of Luke 22 says, "And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground." Something that would have stood out to him, something that would have been astounded to a physician. Never seen anything like this. Somebody get in that particular state where it's like so intent and focused and that the capillaries in the forehead just begin to open up, let blood mingle with the sweat that's running down in the black blood. Luke points this out for us. It was a medical curiosity to him. He thought it was important to emphasize or to bring out in his gospel, whereas the others didn't. We also, this is already in Luke chapter 22. Go down to verse 50. And we have something that is recorded in all of the Gospels. It says, there comes to arrest Jesus. In verse 50 says, one of them struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. Now John also mentions it at his right ear. Other two don't. They cut off his ear. There's a little more detail, a little more focus on which ear was cut off, or on that particular aspect. The account is in all four Gospels. I said Luke's Gospel was Luke, and I've got that information from Peter, because Peter mentions that too. That's the writer. Not Peter. John mentions that. My name is all on top of it. John in his account, it was the writer, but John's the only one that said it was Peter. John's the only one that seemed felt the need to call Peter out. So just that, it was him that decided that it was time to strike. None of these, even Luke doesn't mention that it was Peter. And what about John? Well, the Gospel of John, that we understand to be written by the Apostle John, who was a disciple of Jesus Christ, one of the 12. We have the four Gospels. We know that we have three that harmonize with each other. We've got Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John wrote his own account. Virtually a good 90% of it doesn't parallel with the other Gospels. It brings up a discussion sometimes about John puts the incident where Jesus Christ drove the money changers out of the temple in an earlier time period than the other Gospels put it. So people ask the question, well, maybe he did it twice. Maybe he did. It could have been that John added this later on. There's John. But the book is much later. Now, John was the one that got to live out his life. He was banished and got to live out his life. And he would have read, would have been real familiar with the other indications, the other stories about Jesus Christ. Wouldn't have felt the need to rehash everything nobody else said. He was writing it from his point of view, maybe filling in a lot of the details. A different way of John coming toward the end of his life, the people have been telling the fishing story so long that it begins to trail off. It's like even you know, and it becomes a little familiar. So we need to sort of realign that, to tell things that hadn't been told yet, to observe things that weren't told in the other three Gospels. So that's probably why John had so much unique content. We know that John referred to as the disciple that Jesus loved. And because of his special friendship, special relationship with Christ, he saw and heard things no one else saw and heard. He was with Christ in places other Gospels weren't with him. So he could report on those things. Now, John was the only one that actually went through the crucifixion, but he was Christ's closest told him to take it in my mouth. Whatever. We go to John chapter 1. Most of the time we think of John 1, we think about John explaining that Christ was the Word. We go on down to verse 43 of John chapter 1. And so the following day, Jesus went to go to Galilee. And he found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. So we have this calling here of Philip. Wasn't recorded in the other gospel. We also have this intentional where Philip was from. There's another point to be made later on. They're important things that the people that were coming to the disciples that wanted to believe. Added details. So only John is giving us this origin story for Philip, gives us certain information, gives us interesting background of people that people would be interested in who are at the beginning of their faith in Jesus Christ. We see that these identities of the writers of the gospel fit their perspective, their character, the type of information that we would expect based upon what they wrote in their gospel. And it's how the authenticity of the gospels are confirmed is through the detail. It's not through the overall picture of what they wrote. But that would be the same in all of them, but it's like these little details, things that other people brought out. But it fits in through the other stories. We see that these individuals, as we said, they were humble. The accounts that they made were humble. You know, they didn't brag about themselves. Matthew chapter 10, pretty much far from it in some cases, Matthew chapter 10, which says that John was a disciple that Christ loved, and when he mentioned that he doesn't faith, means he says the disciple that Christ loved. And you have to kind of figure out that it was him from your other ad readings. And Matthew chapter 10, beginning of verse 2, it says, "Now the names of the 12 apostles are these. First, Simon, who is called Peter, Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus, Lebedeus, whose surname was Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him." Backing up to, so it gives the list of them. We back up to verse 3. And whose account are we reading? We're reading Matthew's account. Matthew said about Matthew. Matthew, and also Matthew's a tax collector. Did he have to put that in? It shows the humility, and of course, found that humility, you know. He wouldn't have had it initially on his calling, but he found it over time. He saw this done up. He said, "Yeah, you know, he is right, and I was a tax collector." Tax collectors were hated individuals. They were the least favorably treated individuals. You know, they were considered almost criminals, or practically traitors to their own people. Their job was to collect a certain amount of money for their own government. They were free to squeeze whatever else they could out of the people in their area, in their district. So they were seen as corrupt people. Matthew says, "That's what I was. One of those. One of those horrible tax collectors." And then he just sort of has to admit to it, goes out of his way to say it. No reason for it to necessarily fall in this account. So we see a great deal of humility on the part of Matthew in this part. At the same time, the other disciples sort of without denying it, they didn't blow it up. Mark 2, And verse 14. And verse 14 says, and he, talking about Jesus Christ, he passed by, he saw Levi. He's like, this is Matthew Levi, this same individual, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax office. And he said to him, follow me. Mark didn't say he was a tax collector. He didn't disrespect him in that way. He just said, yeah, he was sitting there at the tax booth. He was a tax collector. He doesn't do it out of I'm a mean spirit or anything. Yeah, I'm a horrible tax collector. Luke chapter 5. Very similar thing. Luke chapter 5. And verse 27. So that's the same thing. And after these things, Christ went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax office. He said to him, follow me. So he's confirming that this was an individual here sitting at the tax office there. But then Luke, after saying this, sort of gives him a little bit of a build-up. Matthew doesn't do for himself. In Luke 5, chapter went out to verse 29. Chapter 5, verse 29. It says, after he said, follow me. At verse 20, it says, he left all, rose up, and followed him. And then verse 29, then Levi gave him a great seat in his own house. And there were a great number of tax collectors and others who sat down with him. Of course, the scribes and the Pharisees, the objections of this, the other people were in here. But Levi took Jesus in his own house is a big feast at this point in time. What does Levi or Matthew say about that in his account? In Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9 and verse 9, they say that Jesus passed home from Mary and saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, follow me. So he arose and followed him. And in verse 10, did you say, well, I gave him, and Matthew said, I gave him a great big feast. He said, no. Verse 10, he said, now, it happened that Jesus sat at the table in the house. Who's out? Matthew's out. Matthew had a big, fine house. He sat at the table in the house. That the whole new tax collectors and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. Once again, the Pharisees paid his exception to this. So Matthew doesn't choose his own form at that time. Only the man himself would be choose to be humble on a point like that. Only true witnesses would talk about the man in this way. People who knew him wanted to show respect, especially in their tax holders, where tax collectors were so hated. Let's go back for a minute for our account about the New England Chronicle newspaper and the Continental Journal account. The two different men were the first to publicly read the Declaration of Independence to a cheering crowd at 1 p.m. on the same day, in the same place, the state out of Boston. Is this even possible? Well, 65 years after today, a man named Daniel Greenlee had wrote an account and had it published. So we're hearing from 65 years after the event, an individual who was alive at this time, he wrote the following. He said, the Declaration of Independence was read by William Greenlee, my father, the sheriff. He goes on to say, my father was so proud of that proclamation that he had the paper from which he read framed in glass and hung over his father's fireplace. As his voice was rather weak, he requested Colonel Thomas Craft to act as his parable. They stood together at the front of the house. My father would read a sentence, which was immediately repeated by Colonel Kraft. And so they continued to the end, when there was hoopah. I guess that was a word of applause and enlightenment at the time. Not really familiar with the term hoopah. It continued to the end with a hoopah. Well, do we trust that? It's pretty amazing. Just that little statement just makes us feel better by reading that. So why do we believe that? Well, the man was alive at the time. First off, it's an eyewitness account. It's authentic. It comes from the son of the man who was there. He was a trustworthy source. And there was humility. He didn't make his father out to be some larger-than-life person, but he admitted his dad had a real weak voice. He couldn't trumpet out the message yet, but he was still so proud of it that he hung it over his father, his parlor fireplace. One final point here is that the Gospels are interlocking. You say there's people will find discrepancies and try to point these out, but say, well, it can't be true. It's not all the same, right? No one here was lying. They weren't trying to hide anything. But in the course of telling the story, they told slightly different stories, told from different perspectives, from different angles. Said it, as we found out in the story of the Declaration of Independence, this happens in truthful testimony all the time. And it happens throughout the Gospels. Not that the Gospels contradict each other, but they can have differences that may make it look like they are telling different stories. But the truth always ends up fitting together in a very unique way, in a way that is difficult to face. One of the John chapter 6. John chapter 6. We're going to talk about the feeding of the 5,000. Maybe something that nobody's ever brought up, or what anything I've really ever focused on or been heard stories about. But we look at how the accounts tend to bring things together. We talked about one of the exclusives to the book of John was that calling of Philip. We even read through it there in John 1:44. Philip was from a town called Bethsaida. Now, in John chapter 6, going down to verse 4, it says, now the Passover feast of the Jews was near. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and seeing a great multitude coming towards him, he said to Philip, where shall we buy bread that these may eat? Did he pick it on Philip? Why did he call Philip out? He's not Peter, not one thing to be, in charge. He's sort of a minor character. Jesus Christ turned to him and said, where can we buy bread? We go to Luke, chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. Verse 10. Luke chapter 9, verse 10. It says, and the apostles, when they had returned, told him all that they had done. Then he took them and went by privately into a deserted place belonging to a city called Bethsaida. So they're at Bethsaida. Point is, chapter 9 was talking about speaking of the 5,000. So, we're at Bethsaida. Peter is still from Bethsaida. That's one Jesus right there. You're from here, why don't we go get bread? Of course, you know, go back and read Peter, still stands and listen. And I'm like, whoa, I'm here for all these people, you know? So we have that aspect. Luke never bothered to tell us that what was from Bethsaida. Luke didn't even bother to tell us that Philip was the guy that Christ asked where to get bread. John is the one that tells us Philip from Bethsaida. John doesn't tell us they were in Bethsaida. But that's why Jesus Christ asked it. So it fits together. It's very, very small detail, but it all fits together. This is why Jesus Christ would have asked them. Which is, that's the ring. Then it ran Luke. Get down to verse 14. You know, kind of backing up. Verse 14. Says, and there were about 5,000 men. Then he said, Jesus Christ, he said to the disciples, make them sit down in groups of 50. And verse 15 says, what it is, so make them all sit down. Go to Mark chapter 6 from Mark's account of this particular episode. Mark chapter 6. Going down to verse 39. So then he commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in ranks, in hundreds, and in fifties. Okay, were they hundreds or were they fifties? Well, if you got 5,000 people, and you got 100 rows of 50, you got 5,000 people. So it could have been in rows of 50 or groups of 50. The other disciples, I'm bothered to mention this aspect of rows and groups and what have you, say, the 5,000 people. We have this little detail here where they agree without actually saying the same thing. So we find that kind of detail in the small point. What do we say about the works then as whole? Is there any reason for us to doubt that 5,000 people sat down across a hillside listening to a man named Jesus preach? We all agree on that aspect, don't we? We have different accounts from the writers of the gospel, but they did agree. They did agree that Jesus Christ came, that Jesus Christ did undeniable miracles everywhere that he went, that he was ultimately betrayed, tortured, killed, and then resurrected. The truth is confirmed. Sometimes in subtle, even meticulous, perhaps even boring details. And that each of the writers were unique, but they all bring us an authenticity of the gospel. We see it interlocking like puzzle pieces in the details. And it adds up to one huge mountain of evidence. If we're only judging the gospel with the approval of intellect and reason, we'd be forced to conclude that they were true based on the evidence. You and I have much more than that. We recently went through the Feast of Pentecost. We know that we have the Spirit of the living God within us that convicts us, that changes our lives. We can see the evidence of God working with us today. We don't necessarily need to go into the details to determine that they're accurate. We have God's Spirit we experience through faith and interaction with God. The Holy Spirit teaches us about Him. And we can rest assured that the book is true. There is no legitimate challenge to the authority and truthfulness of the Bible. Well, what do we do with that information? Well, doing what we're doing. We serve God. We serve God with conviction. That's founded in our faith and love. And also founded firmly in reason and in truth.